This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So much climate change is taking place in the Arctic, and those giant events could soon sweep the world into a hotter age, believe it or not. There are a few good blogs about it, like Arctic News, but really we need a full-time Arctic TV news station or something. Until that comes, let's get some of this summer's top climate stories in the North from Paul Beckwith. He's the University of Ottawa climate undergrad with two master's degrees already to his credit. And as it happens, Paul has just returned from a visit to Alaska. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I've been out in the garden picking food and putting things away, canning it. And I gather you've just been on a trip to Alaska. Did you pick up anything interesting for our listeners while you were there?
Well, it's one thing to study and, read papers about the changes that are going on in the Arctic, and it's quite another thing to actually experience it yourself. So had a very busy week, in the northern regions last week. It was vacation, so near Juneau, took a helicopter ride, landed on the Mendenhall Glacier, which is just northwest of the city. I'd never done that before, never been on the glacier, so it was very interesting. Loads of meltwater ponds, loads of rivers on top of the surface. What really struck me most about the glacier, apart from the enormous scale, and as we go further north, there's less trees around and very few buildings, so it's extremely difficult to get an idea, get a sense of scale. Like you're looking at something and it seems like you could reach your hand out and grab it and it's, 10 miles away sort of thing, 10 kilometers away. So the meltwater ponds, there was a very large moulin. It was a beautifully clear day, which was very unusual according to the helicopter pilot. But myself and my family walked around on top of the glacier, right, probably too close to the moulin. And I took loads of movies and pictures, which I'll post on Facebook or on a website to let people access. So that was one thing. And then we also saw, just prior to that, I actually climbed up to the base camp, Camp Muir, in Mount Rainier in Washington State. That's about the 10,000-foot level, and there's many glaciers coming off there. And the thing that struck me there is the persistent noise. You could hear avalanches going on in the distance, and you could hear trees splintering and stuff, but you would look around, and you couldn't see where they were coming from. So it was very busy. It was on a Saturday, and the trails, lots of people going up. And then just a week ago, Thursday, I was on a boat in Glacier Bay, which is part of Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska. It's just west of Skagway. But there's many, many glaciers, tidewater glaciers, that are calving off into the bay. And this bay was completely covered by ice 200 years ago. It's 65 miles long. It's about 14 miles wide. And it's about 800 feet deep, and it was completely covered by ice, like I said, 200 years ago. And the ice has been receding, of course, and the rate of melting has increased. And the boat actually goes right up close to the glaciers, and we could actually see a calving of the glaciers that are on the shore. So it was quite a trip. The thing that struck me most about all these things was, one, the color of the ice. I mean, it's very, very dark, very, very black in many cases. So all of the summer snow would have melted, and we're melting into the core of the glacier, and the dirt and dust and sediments that are in the ice get concentrated. So that was one thing. And then, of course, I mentioned the scale of, you're looking at this glacier wall, and it's 300 feet high, and you really have no way to judge that, how tall it is.
Yes, we humans are used to having buildings all around us, and we judge everything from our own creations. And you step out into a big, wide atmosphere, it's hard to place yourself if you're a city dweller, I think. Well, I'd like, Paul, to get to some of the big stories out of the Arctic this summer, and one that got a lot of eyeballs, whether it was that important or not, was the crater that blew up in Siberia, apparently a methane explosion. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that it's a very sort of unexpected phenomenon. I mean, it was a bit of a mystery at first, but apparently they found several of them. And what it is probably, I mean, there's still a lot of study. There'll still be a lot of papers on it. But they have measured high levels of methane near the bottom of it and surrounding it. I think they've pretty much determined that it is due to methane. That was in question at first, but that was the most likely scenario. So basically, what probably happened is it was like an area of unfrozen ground underneath the surface metallic, and if a lot of water in there drained away, it would have created a cavern and then just a collapse. So that's probably the processes that were involved in forming it. So it is an indication that the thawing of the frozen permafrost and tundra is happening rapidly enough to cause these types of things to occur, both on the terrestrial, on the land. And there is evidence under the ocean that this has happened many times in the past to much larger extents, particularly on some of the continental shelves near New Zealand. There's pockmarks on the ocean floor that are believed to be perhaps a similar phenomena with a very large, you know, world-changing methane burst.
Well, you know, later in September, I hope to talk with a scientist who just released a paper. He was the lead author of a paper that found up to 700 methane vents off the east coast of North America. And that was kind of surprising to me. We picture methane, that's the Arctic. But no, it's happening right off the east coast.
Yes, this paper, I think it just came out this week, in fact. And apparently, they only measured about three or four previous. So what they did is they did a very detailed survey of this particular region. And this time they determined that there were 570. Now, one thing that they did say is that many of these vents have calcium buildups around the vents, which would seem to indicate, and they could date those. So some of these vents, or many of these vents, is sort of unclear, but a number of these vents have been there for 100 years or even up to 1,000 years. So if that's the case, if most of them have been venting for a long time and just not detected by us, then that's not so much of a concern because they've been going on for a long time. We just didn't know about it. We didn't consider it as a source of methane. However, if, you know, many of them are new events that are due to warmer seawater on the ocean floor causing a breakthrough of the layer down to the class rates, causing them to melt and release the methane, then that's a bigger problem. That's a new source. So I think what this certainly means is that we need to pay much more attention to measuring methane around the planet everywhere. We need to get a much better handle on it because it's a huge has a huge global warming potential on a short time scale. You know, it's over 100 times that of CO2, or even on a few year time scale, 150, 160 or more, up to 200 times that of CO2 on a few year time scale, right? So this is the key.
There could be a burst of heat from the methane. We've talked about that in the past. And the well-known ice scientist Jason Box just used the F word in a tweet to describe our situation if Arctic methane gets released in quantity. Why are scientists so worried about this?
Well, what we're finding out is that the weather systems of our planet are much more sensitive to the jet streams behavior. We know that weather is affected by jet stream behavior, but what was unexpected was that the jet streams would slow down, would be affected as much by the current level of warming in the Arctic. And if you go to the high Arctic, the warming is 6 to 8 times faster than that of the rest of the planet. I mean, it's typically over a degree Celsius per decade, whereas the rest of the planet is like 0.15 or something degrees Celsius per decade. So, and the oceans are warming up there. The warm oceans that surround the Arctic are starting to penetrate into the Arctic. I mean, the whole region is warmer. We're getting a lot more fires. We're getting a lot more ash settling down and darkening things. I think Jason Box also recently mentioned, I think he's in Greenland now or was recently, and he said that the, you know, it's as dark as he's seen it. Of course, when it's darker, that means more absorption of sunlight, more heating, more melting.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that in just a second. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Climate Hound Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. This thing with fires, first of all, there were huge fires in the Arctic this year, including in Alaska, and including some fires reported burning in the tundra where there aren't even trees. What can you tell us about the fire situation?
You know, when the ground is frozen, of course, you know, it doesn't burn that easily. The problem is a couple things. First, not only is it warming, and, you know, that's leading to more vegetation growth, which then is susceptible to more burning in the dry seasons. And also, you know, in some regions, we're getting much more rainfall in certain seasons. And when it rains, the water coming down is, of course, you know, warmer, and it percolates through the frozen ground. And it's pretty flat there, so, you know, if there's terrain, a lot of groundwater ends up in rivers and then flows elsewhere. But, you know, it's pretty flat over long areas, long regions. So the water just kind of sits on the surface and percolates downward and causes thawing. And then when there's the dry season, you have that whole surface layer of high carbon content that is, you know, breaking down. The bacteria breaking it down is producing, you know, CO2 right at the surface and methane a little bit below. It's also much drier and susceptible to burn. So, you know, lightning, and also if there's more storms, thunderstorms, more storm systems, then the lightning strikes can trigger the fires. And we don't have a lot of resources up there to fight these fires. So water bombers have to, the resources we have for fighting fires is much less in the Arctic regions, in North America and Siberia as well.
As far as I know, they just let them burn. I mean, that's really all you can do up there.
Yeah, they let them burn, and they can burn for a long time because if the peat underneath the ground is thawed, you know, and dry, then it starts burning, and those peat fires can burn for long periods of time.
And that's a lot of carbon. And so, you know, from the soot, which, as you mentioned, in Greenland, Jason Box has pointed out, the black particles are causing the ice to melt faster there. And that soot went right around the world. Then you add what you've just talked about, the peat and all sorts of factors. I'm wondering if Arctic fires themselves aren't becoming a positive feedback loop for global warming.
Yes, they are definitely a positive feedback. You really need to look at the sort of the rate of increase of area burned. And of course, there is fluctuation from year to year. But, you know, if you look at the trend over the last few decades, there's definitely a large uptick of fires. And there's also fires that are occurring in regions where there weren't fires before. So, you know, there's a rejuvenation process after there's a fire, and that can take a very long time in the Arctic versus in, you know, a boreal forest at lower latitudes. But many of these regions that are burning haven't had, if you do a sample of sediments in a lake up there or something and look at the carbon content, you can determine the number of fires, get an idea for the paleo, like the number of fires through history, back through time, and you can see some regions just haven't had an extremely low frequency of fires, and they're getting fires now. So it's another feedback in the system.
Well, pardon me, I feel a rant coming up because in Canada, the home of the tar sands, where we closed our Arctic research station, where we leased out our Arctic research ship to oil companies for exploration, our Prime Minister Harper is giving photo ops on board a military ship searching for the Franklin expedition that was lost in the 1800s. And the irony is, Paul, for me, if the explorers had set out today, they probably would never have been trapped in the ice. They might have sailed right through the newly melted Northwest Passage. The Prime Minister doesn't see the irony of pushing more oil drilling in the Arctic. Now the fossil fuels have melted that same sea ice. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a family program, so I can't understand how the Harper government can continue their. I mean, they just ignore climate change. They don't talk about it. You never hear it discussed. You never hear plans mentioned. And, you know, then Harper goes on his tour up north, and there's pictures of him talking to some scientists who are lowering something into the water, or, you know, he's riding on a Zodiac, smiling, waving at the camera, which turns out to be a drone that's flying alongside the boat. So he's waving at this drone. There's no people around that he's waving at. He's just waving at a drone. I mean, it's so transparent, right? But, you know, I guess the question is, you know, do Canadians just buy this stuff, or do they, you know, if they spend a few minutes to just look at what's going on behind the story, you know, they would see how really, like, Monty Python-esque it is.
Well, you know, as I recall, last year you suggested the summer sea ice could melt entirely in 2014 if we had the right wind storms to drive the weakened ice out. That didn't happen. But where are we with sea ice this year?
Well, the sea ice, right now it's tracking in about 7th or 8th place. 2012 minimum sort of was a massive drop compared to any other year. 2007 was maybe 10% drop over previous records, and 2012 was 25% below those records. And then there's a cluster of years at a bit higher level, 3 years or so. So we're tracking a bit behind there, but it's not healthy. It's thin. Because it's thinner, it's less structurally cohesive, so it spreads out more. And when it spreads out more, that causes more reflection of light. So the albedo of the whole area can actually increase, even though the thickness is decreasing. If you look at the curves, if you analyze the curves of ice decline, both area, extent, and thickness, statistically, then there seems to be more variation. You know, it's still trending down exponentially with thickness, but there seems to be a lot of variation around that curve. So, you know, like the U.S. Navy model was saying 2018 or something. Other people are saying 2020. One thing that is clear is that the amount of sea ice loss now and the changing temperature distribution, the Arctic amplification of temperature, is affecting the jet streams, leading to, it's changed the statistics of our weather in terms of torrential rain events. More and more cities are getting their 3 or 6 months of rainfall in a night or two. The California drought is only worsening. So the sea ice is one factor, and also the snow cover in the Arctic is another major factor. So the spring snow cover, and that's also undergoing lots of variation and fluctuation, but I mean the trends are strongly downward, you know. But I mean, making a prediction on this year or that year, it kind of, there's randomness in these fluctuations on top of the strong declines, you know. It's sort of a gambler's bet.
But we know it's going to happen sooner or later, because that's the way it's going. Is there other science from the summer or coming out soon that you would like to tell us about as we start to wrap up here?
Some of the things that I've talked about, you know, the waviness of the, and others have talked about, the waviness of the jet stream, the slowing down of the jet stream, the persistence of the ridges and troughs, like the ridge over California, you know, troughs elsewhere causing some cooling and more rainfall. The connection of that to the Arctic and the temperature distribution and the background changes is getting stronger. There's been a number of papers coming out basically adding more weight to Jennifer Francis's work. Like the story is becoming more consistent. I mean, there's still, you know, a paper just came out, I think, a few days ago that said, yes, there's lots of correlation between the Arctic decline and the jet bending and the extreme weather events, but they were still struggling to have a causation, you know, what they claimed in that paper. I haven't read that paper yet.
No, I haven't either, but I saw notice of it, and there was another one coming out from the Potsdam Institute that did back up Jennifer Francis in her theory. So the jury's still kind of out, but I think it's really that science is struggling to find the actual mechanism of causation, if there is one, and we haven't totally got that yet.
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that there's causation. I mean, just from top-down views of the, you know, you change the temperature distribution, of course you have to change the jet streams. I don't, you know, it's like, I don't know why it's so, I guess, you know, you have to crunch numbers to show it, is how climate scientists work. You know, if there were more physicists in climatology, then they would say, yeah, it's obvious, like it's straightforward.
Well, already the Arctic is changing your world, and it will even more as we see these developments come up. Paul, please tell people how they can find your very active Facebook page.
Yes, if people just Google Paul Beckwith, and the photograph is just me in front of bookshelves. I haven't changed that for a long time. And also on Twitter, Paul H. Beckwith, at Paul H. Beckwith. Everybody can friend me, and I do lots of blogs, lots of posts, and I have a load of photographs from Alaska and the glacier I was on, and also all the Calving glaciers, and also the glacier on Rainier. I'll be posting loads of those pictures shortly.
I'll put a link to some of that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I track Paul's Facebook page as one of my important news sources. So, Paul Beckwith, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Okay, thank you. And can I say one more thing? A couple key links for people. If they Google Climate Reanalyzer, they can get, you know, there's a very good up-to-date image of what's happening around the planet, and then you can click on different menus to select temperature and pressures and see the jet streams and see the sea surface temperatures and currents and so on. And another site that is really, really good, it's a very artistic-looking site, is if you Google Earth Null School. Don't ask me where that name comes from.
Null School, N-U-L-L
school? Yeah, N-U-L-L, Earth Null School. Then there's a link there which shows very detailed images of all of these, those different parameters in more detail than the Climate Reanalyzer. And it's not evident, but if you just click on the Earth, if you click on the text on the bottom left called Earth, then it brings up a menu and you can change what you're looking at. And you can zoom in and out, and it's very, very easy to use, and it's very interesting to see how the whole Earth system is acting. And it's data from the previous day, pretty much. It's almost updated real time.
Super. We'll check that out. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.